The following previews are of graphic audio productions rated for mature audiences due to scenes of intense violence and sexual situations.
Graphic Audio presents DC Comics Justice League of America, Wonder Woman, Mythos.
When Hermione and Chloe read to you out of the ancient text, daughter, did they ever read you a story about an island of men?
You really think there is an island of warriors in this ocean?
Oracle?
Batman, something big just came up. I mean that literally. An island just popped up out of nowhere.
Magic.
I hate magic.
Tonight, we set sail for Themyscira, where our weapons will taste blood.
Superman, you are possessed by Ares.
You ruined everything.
Who the hell died and made you queen, huh?
Come, Diana, puppet of Ares. One of us must die now.
I'm sorry, Mother.
Kill her!
No!
Now, the world will burn.
Copyright 2009, DC Comics, all rights reserved. Justice League of America, Wonder Woman, and all related names, characters, and elements are trademarks of DC Comics.
Available now from Graphic Audio.
Wraith is a patrol ship. She's been in combat against the Blood Horde. We're jumping out to meet them.
Forward hull breach. That'll mean decompression injuries in the nearest compartments beyond the breach.
For all we know, Wraith won't make it until we arrive.
What happened?
We got hauled in as casualties. They're on the DSR.
We're going to be discovered soon. We don't fit in with these...
slaves.
Careful. You still have to do it.
In my sleep, pack leader.
Hey, Serrano, you hear about the mysterious intruders?
Intruders?
Don't move. We don't like Serranos, but we do recognize your value as a hostage. For now.
The Wraith crew members who came aboard as casualties from the forward compartments have not appeared for ID checks. I understand that Lieutenant Sweeza had a notion that they might be Blood Horde intruders.
We need to get our combat experience people over to T3 and T4. There's got to be another way to get through this.
If we can't go inside, how about outside?
Trouble. They're maneuvering. Lieutenant, I don't suppose you know whether the FTL drive is irretrievably broken.
The FTL drive?
This should be interesting.
Got a plan yet?
A two-part plan. Get control of this ship and defeat whatever's waiting for us.
For which we need warships.
If only we could Trojan horse them, the way they did to us.
It can't be done.
Do you really think our people can't figure out the controls on Blood Horde ships? I think they can. I think they will.
Prelim scan, 6. Say again, 6 Blood Horde ships.
We did it! We got ourselves a warship!
Let's get this ship going. Weapons, range in, Captain. Go ahead.
Serrano Legacy, Book 4, Once a Hero, Part 2, from Graphic Audio.
And now, for our feature presentation.
Graphic Audio. A movie in your mind.
Graphic Audio presents James Axler's Outlanders. Narrated by Terrence Aselford. With performances by Thomas Penny, Nanette Savard, Richard Rowan, Colleen Delaney, Dolores King-Williams, David Coyne, Michael John Casey, Karen Carbone, Eric Messner, Scott McCormick, Tim Getman, Ken Jackson, Elizabeth Demery, and Mort Shelby. Outlanders number 45, Ghost Walk. Kane did not hear the shot or see anyone with a gun. The shock of the bullet's impact high on his right shoulder jerked him around, his feet tangling, his back slamming hard against the adobe wall. He let his body sag to the ground. As quickly as he could, he crawled behind a heap of chipped masonry. Pain streaked up and down his arm like flares of heat lightning, but he didn't think any bones were broken. He fingered the small hole punched through his tricolored desert camouflage blouse and winced. His mind swam with anger. He knew he should have checked out every structure in the ruins of the old village before leaving the shelter of the walls, but concern over a missing team member had made him reckless. A single dirt lane led to the settlement, which was a cluster of small huts, most of them roofless, surrounding a well. The north wall had collapsed into rubble and dried mud bricks long ago. The place looked like a typical abandoned outland village, so Kane hadn't strolled through it with any particular caution. He hitched around, careful not to dislodge any loose stones and give away his position. The lowering sun was a blinding red ball. His eyes swept over the featureless sandy plain. Less than 100 yards to his right rose a range of low hills with a rolling tongue of sand dunes between them. High rust-red mesas towered between the low hills. He resisted taking a drink from his canteen, straining his hearing for any sound of movement. Sand and the dry wind sapped all the juices from his body, parching the throat and dehydrating the flesh. The sun dropped down behind one of the flat-topped outcroppings, and long shadows stretched toward him. Heat waves blurred the far horizon. The peaks of the Jemez mountain range were only a wavering mirage many miles to the south. Kane had been walking point, a habit he had acquired during his years as a magistrate because of his uncanny ability to detect imminent danger. When he walked point, Kane felt electrically alive, sharply tuned to every nuance of his surroundings and what he was doing. Most of the time, he could sense danger from far off. Now, he wondered if his senses, his instincts, were failing him. In potential kill zones, he normally walked with such care it was almost a form of paranoia. He had grown accustomed to always being watchful and alert, to expecting the unexpected. This time, his point man sense had let him down. He wondered sourly if he was getting old. Reaching up behind his right ear, he tapped the contact, a flat curve of metal fastened to the mastoid bone by implanted steel pintails. Sensor circuitry incorporated an analog-to-digital voice encoder embedded within the bone. Once the device made full cranial contact, the auditory canal conveyed the radio transmissions directly through the skull casing. Kane touched the volume control.
Oh, damn it.
Quickly, he dialed it back down, grimacing both in frustration and pain. A frequency-dampening field was spread out like a vast umbrella over the village, blocking all radio communications. He could think of only a couple of groups with access to that kind of tech. Brewster Philboyd had volunteered to scout out the zone to prove his suspicions. When Kane declined to grant him permission, Philboyd had gone anyway. He had not returned. Clenching his teeth, Kane inched toward one of the lengthening shadows. Although his shoulder burned fiercely from the impact of the bullet, he carefully flexed the tendons of his right wrist. The Sin-Eater slid from its forearm holster and into the palm of his hand. His fingers tingled with a painful pins-and-needles sensation, and they barely stirred. Kane's ears pricked at the footsteps. Carefully, he leaned over to peer around the base of the rock heap. A man stepped through a wide crack in the adobe wall. Because he was backlit by the shimmering corona of the setting sun, Kane couldn't pick out specific details beyond the very long-barreled pistol in the man's right fist. The stranger moved quickly and with a purpose, walking heel to toe with expert ease, keeping the wall to his right. Kane pushed the Sin-Eater back into the holster. He noted the footlong sound suppressor that was screwed into the bore of the man's auto pistol. The silencer had successfully reduced the noise of the gunshot, but had also reduced the bullet's velocity sufficiently so it had only knocked Kane down rather than penetrating the spectrofabric of his shadow suit. A sound suppressor seemed a very strange attachment for a man on foot out in the wastelands of New Mexico, but Kane had no time to wonder about it. With his left hand, he drew the 14-inch-long combat knife from the sheath at his waist. He gripped the Nilex handle tightly while he tried to coax more feeling into his right arm. He waited, barely breathing, listening for sounds of the gunman's progress. He listened to the stealthy tramp of feet, realizing that the way the man soft-footed through the loose gravel and sand indicated he wasn't sure of his shot. Kane felt pressure moving along his nerves, and he rose to a crouch, favoring his injured shoulder. A shadow crept slowly across the ground toward him. Then it halted. Kane figured the gunman was eyeing the pile of rock, guessing that his quarry was hiding behind it. The man advanced in a smooth, fast rush. In his eagerness to get past the heap of stone, he grazed the wall with a knee and was thrown slightly off balance. He stumbled, reaching out to steady himself. Kane slashed out with the knife, the razored edge penetrating the leather of a jump boot and slicing the tendon at the man's left heel. The man staggered forward, leg buckling. His shoulder slammed against an unyielding wall of sun-baked clay. Kane caught an impression of a smooth, round face contorted in agony and surprise. The hollow bore of the sound suppressor swung toward him. Although he gave the handgun only the most fleeting of glances, he identified it as a Coleco M950 rimfire. Kane dodged to one side. With his right hand, he knocked the pistol aside, pinned his opponent against the wall, and whipped the blade of the combat knife forward, stopping the razor edge a hairbreadth from the man's throat. For a long second, the two men stared into each other's eyes. A round button on the man's dun-colored coverall glinted with dim sun sparks. The inscribed image showed a stylized representation of a featureless man holding a cornucopia, a horn of plenty in his left hand, and a sword in his right, both crossed over his chest. No words were imprinted on it, but none were necessary.
The Millennial Consortium. I should have known.
The Cerebus crew. We did know.
The Millennialist started to bring up his weapon. Kane's Sin Eater slapped into his palm, the barrel smacking the side of the man's head as it popped from the holster. Kane's prisoner squeezed his eyes shut in anticipation of a bullet plowing a path through hair, flesh, bone, and brain. Kane didn't depress the trigger stud or even increase the pressure of the knife blade.
You're leaking a lot of blood, pal. If you want to keep enough of it in you to stay alive, I'm your only option.
The Millennialist's skin was pinked by the sun, and his wispy blonde hair was cut very short. He resembled most of the other consortium grunts Kane had met over the past few years. He looked to be in his early 30s.
All right. All right.
He opened his hand and the Coleco dropped to the ground. Picking up the man's pistol, Kane took the knife away from the man's throat.
What's your name?
What difference does it make?
None. I just thought it was the polite thing to ask of a man I've probably crippled.
Wincing, the man reached for the scarlet seeping slash at the back of his boot.
Call me Mr. Gray.
Kane smiled slightly, recalling the pair of color-coded millennialists he had met in Europe.
You can call me...
Kane, I've seen pics of you. Your file is black-tagged. You're a high-priority target. Big bonus pay for any of us who nails you.
Gray glanced sourly at the Coleco in Kane's hand.
Guess I got too eager, but I could swear I got you.
You did. Just not as good as I got you.
Kane eyed the man's injured foot. He popped the magazine out of the Coleco and tossed the weapon over his shoulder.
Let me see what I can do about getting that boot off.
Gray looked longingly toward the Coleco.
They've been making us pay for every gun we lose.
Yeah, the consortium has a reputation for squeezing every penny until it screams.
Kane wedged his knife against Gray's bootlaces and sliced. They parted easily.
We're thrifty! There's a difference.
Kane rolled his eyes as he carefully tugged off the man's boot. Blood acted as lubricant. Although the pain must have been excruciating, Gray merely sank his teeth into his lower lip without making a sound. The Millennial Consortium was, on the surface, a group of organized traders who dedicated their lives to recovering pre-dark artifacts from the ruins of cities. In the Outlands, such scavenging was actually the oldest profession. Looting the abandoned ruins of pre-dark cities was less a vocation than it was an Outland tradition. Entire generations of families had made careers of ferreting out and plundering the secret stockpiles the pre-dark government had hidden in anticipation of a nationwide catastrophe. The locations of those hidden man-made caverns, filled with hardware, fuel, and weapons, had become legend to the descendants of the Nukecost survivors. Most of the redoubts had been found and raided decades ago, but occasionally a hitherto untouched one would be located. As the stockpiles became fewer, so did the independent salvaging and trading organizations. Various trader groups had combined resources for the past several years, forming consortiums and absorbing the independent operators. The consortiums employed and fed people in the Outlands and gave them a sense of security that had once been the sole province of the barons. There were some critics who compared the trader consortiums to the barons and talked of them with just as much ill will. Since first hearing of the Millennial Consortium a few years earlier, the Cerberus warriors had learned firsthand that the organization was deeply involved in activities beyond seeking out stockpiles, salvaging, and trading. The Millennial Consortium's ultimate goal was to rebuild America along the tenets of a technocracy, with a board of scientists and scholars governing the country and directing the resources to where they saw the greatest need. Although the consortium's goals seemed utopian, the organization's overall policy was pragmatic beyond the limit of cold-bloodedness. Their influence was widespread, but they were completely ruthless when it came to the furtherance of their agenda, which was essentially the totalitarianism of techno-tyranny. Nor were their movements restricted to the continental United States. Not too long before, Cerberus had thwarted a consortium operation in Slovakia. Kane examined the knife wound. His blade hadn't completely severed Gray's Achilles tendon. Even so, Kane doubted the men would ever be able to walk without a limp again. From a pouch pocket of his pants, Kane took out a long bandana and folded it, then expertly knotted it around the man's wound to staunch the flow of blood.
Once I hook back up with my team, I'll have access to a medical kit and can get you some proper bandages and even a painkiller. You don't seem surprised to hear about my team, or even what I'm doing out here.
Gray's sweat-pebbled face tightened.
We expected you.
And why is that?
We found your spy.
Kane laid a hand on Gray's injured ankle.
What spy?
He said his name was Philboyd, that he was a scientist, and that we should back off.
Kane tightened his fingers around Gray's ankle.
Where is he?
He's not dead. I swear to you, we didn't kill him.
I asked where he was.
I can show you.
I'm sure you can. And you'll show us a lot more besides.
Kane released the man's ankle and stood up. He gazed beyond Gray.
You hear any of that?
Mr. Gray's face registered momentary confusion. Then he turned to see Cerberus Away Team Alpha stepping through a break in the wall. The six people were attired in tricolored desert camouflage BDUs and thick-soled tan jump boots. All of them carried abbreviated copperhead subguns attached to combat webbing over their field jackets. Optical image intensifier scopes and laser auto-targeters were mounted on top of the frames. Low recoil allowed the copperheads to be fired in long, devastating full-auto bursts. Four members of Team Alpha also carried XM-29 assault rifles. Grant strode up to Gray and stared down at him, his eyes shadowed by heavy, overhanging brows. He towered 6 feet 5 inches tall in his thick-soled jump boots, and his shoulders spread out on either side of a thickly tendoned neck like massive planks, straining at the seams of his field jacket. Although he looked too huge and thick-hewn to have many abilities beyond brute strength, Grant was an exceptionally intelligent and talented man. Behind the fierce, deep-set eyes, the down-sweeping mustache, black against the dark brown of his skin, granite jaw and broken nose, lay a mind rich with tactics, strategies, and painful experience. Like Kane, he had lived a great deal of his life surrounded by violence. He had been shot, stabbed, battered, beaten, burned, buried, and once very nearly suffocated on the surface of the moon. Kane nodded to Gray.
Gray, this is Grant. Grant, Gray.
I know who he is. The consortium is very thorough when it comes to identifying its enemies.
All of you millennialists look like you were mass-produced. Same build, same haircuts.
And you usually say the same thing when we meet any millennialists.
Bridget's right, I almost forgot. I hate you guys.
Bridget Baptiste stepped between Grant and Kane, gazing down at Gray with bright emerald eyes. She was a tall woman with a fair complexion. Her mane of red-gold hair fell down her back in a long sunset-colored braid to the base of her spine. Like the other members of Cat Alpha, she wore desert camouflage. A TP-9 auto pistol was snugged in a cross-draw rig strapped around her waist. Kneeling down beside Gray, she lifted the lid of a square medical kit.
I think we can dress your injury a bit more properly.
Gray gave her a beseeching look of gratitude.
Something for the pain, too, please. I'm really hurting.
I don't doubt it.
Bridget busied herself with the contents of the kit, then paused.
Of course, you'll have to give me something in return.
The expression of gratitude on Gray's face turned to resentment.
Like what?
Edwards, the ex-mag from Samariumville, marched forward and prodded Gray roughly in the ribs with a boot.
What do you think, dipshit? Information.
Edwards, whose head was shaved, wasn't as tall as Grant, but he was almost as broad, with overdeveloped triceps, biceps, and deltoids. He usually served as the commander of Cat Alpha in the absence of Kane and Grant.
I don't know anything. I'm just a grunt.
That's the pat response we expected. I'm sure you can guess our response.
Grant positioned his right boot over Gray's bandaged ankle and, balancing on his heels, slowly began exerting downward pressure. Gray swallowed hard.
Okay!
Grant lifted his foot, but kept the thickly treaded sole hovering over the millennialist's ankle.
Okay what?
If you're here at all, you'll probably know as much as I do about the operation.
Kane repressed the urge to exchange meaningful glances with Bridget and Grant. In truth, Cerberus knew very little. The information about sudden and suspicious activity on the outskirts of the little settlement near Los Alamos had reached them by the most inefficient of means, word of mouth. The information had been conveyed along a chain of roamer bands until it finally reached the ears of Skydog in Montana. He, in turn, had brought it to the Cerberus Redoubt, cloistered atop a mountain peak in the Bitterroot Range.
Tell us what you know anyway.
Gray gestured vaguely in the direction of the sand dunes and mesas.
You're familiar with the mandate of the consortium, right?
Yeah. To dig out old pre-dark tech, polish it up, and try to figure out a way to use it to enslave your fellow human beings.
If you want to believe that about us, go ahead. It's not true, but keep on believing it if it'll make you feel better.
Thanks. I will.
Get back to the subject. Like, for instance, why were you patrolling out here with a silenced weapon?
Fear flickered in Gray's eyes a moment before he dropped his gaze.
We didn't want to draw attention if we had to shoot at something.
Whose attention?
Gray shifted uncomfortably, fingering the bandage around his ankle.
Whose attention?
The Ghost Walkers.
What the hell does that mean?
Mr. Gray swallowed the pentazocine tablet handed to him by Bridget.
I don't really know much. Just what I was told.
Which was?
We've had reports from the locals that when anybody starts digging around Phantom Mesa, ghosts show up.
Ghosts?
Bridget cast a glance over her shoulder at the rock formations.
Which one is Phantom Mesa?
Third from the left. Your left. The reports say the ghosts walk around like they're guarding the place. Supposedly, they even kill people who defy their orders to leave.
Folklore. The whole history of the Southwest is a patchwork of legends and superstitions.
Mr. Gray flashed her a fleeting, appreciative smile, but it faded quickly.
That's what our section chief thought, too. But I figure it's called Phantom Mesa for a reason, right? We've seen some strange-ass shit, though. Enough so we take precautions. The locals claim the ghosts don't show up unless you make a lot of noise, so we use silencers on our guns.
Speaking of them, where are the locals?
Gray gestured out toward the sand dunes.
We gave them jobs, put them to work with our excavation crew.
Right. I remember the employment opportunities offered by the Millennial Consortium. Another name for it is forced servitude. Just what are they excavating out there?
I'm not sure about anything specifically, but this whole part of New Mexico was a testing site for all sorts of pre-dark research. Weapons, aircraft, even genetics.
We know.
Bridget managed to keep her expression from betraying the involuntary surge of revulsion as she recalled the bioengineering facility known as Nightmare Alley, hidden deep beneath the Archuleta Mesa. Several years ago, she had participated in its complete destruction.
The consortium found a facility in almost pristine condition.
A continuity of government redoubt, like the one you millennialists occupied in Wyoming?
Mr. Gray considered Grant's questions for a few seconds, then shook his head.
Don't think so. It's above ground, not like most of the redoubts. It's more like a station of some sort, set in a little valley between Phantom Mesa and another one. Very well hidden, unless you know where to look.
If that's the case, how'd you know where to look?
We grunts didn't. Our section chief knew where to look.
Who's that again?
We call her Boss Bitch. Not to her face, though.
Kane's eyes narrowed, recalling the last time they had questioned a couple of millennialists. They had referred to a female section chief, too.
How did she know?
She took over from another chief, Mr. Breach. He laid the groundwork.
And where is he now?
A lot of us would like to know that.
What about Phil Boyd?
Mr. Gray blinked up at Edwards curiously.
What about him? Where the fuck is he?
I don't know. He was taken away to be questioned, but he was alive. Could I have a drink? That pill is stuck in my throat.
Edwards, give him your canteen.
The big ex-mag scowled, but he didn't object. Kane glanced meaningfully toward Bridget and Grant and jerked his head. The three people walked away, out of earshot of the consortium man.
Do we believe him?
Bridget shrugged and ran a hand through her hair.
I don't see why not. If the consortium is out here, something big has attracted their attention.
I don't mean that. He could be giving us wrong directions.
Grant narrowed his eyes against the glare of the setting sun.
Even so, we've got to check out his story no matter what.
Bridget smiled wryly and nodded.
Unfortunately.
Kane worked his shoulder up and down, wincing in pain.
Damn it.
What?
That son of a bitch shot me. Didn't penetrate, but it hurts like hell.
Let me make sure.
Kane shucked out of his field jacket and opened a magnetic seal in the upper half of his bodysuit, peeling it down over his right shoulder. His upper torso still burned where the bullet had punched him. A livid red and purple bruise spread in a star-shaped pattern around the impact point. Bridget probed with gentle fingers at the injury.
I think you'll be all right, but your arm will probably be very stiff in a couple of hours. When we get back to Cerberus, have DeFore look at it.
Kane resealed the seam, grimacing against the pain. Bridget and Grant wore identical midnight-colored garments under their BDUs. Although the material of the form-fitting coveralls resembled black doe skin and didn't seem as if it would offer protection from flea bites, the suits were impervious to most radiation. Upon finding the one-piece garments in the Operation Kronos facility on Thunder Isle several years earlier, Kane had christened them shadow suits. Later, they learned that a manufacturing technique known in pre-dark days as electrospin lacing had electrically charged polymer particles to form a single crystal metallic microfiber with a dense molecular structure. Kane maintained the shadow suits were superior to the polycarbonate magistrate armor, chiefly for their internal subsystems. Also, they were almost impossible to tear or pierce with a knife, but a heavy caliber bullet could penetrate them. And unlike the mag body armor, the shadow suit wouldn't redistribute the kinetic shock. Kane turned back toward where the rest of Alpha Team waited with their prisoner.
Edwards!
The man strode toward him swiftly.
Sir!
Baptiste, Grant, and I will scout out ahead.
An uneasy expression settled over Edwards' face.
With our comm signals being jammed, you could walk into a trap and we'd be none the wiser.
The jamming umbrella works both ways. Gray couldn't have transmitted a warning, so the consortium is just as much in the dark about us as we are about them.
Unless Brewster talked.
Bridget's eyes narrowed to slits as she turned toward Edwards.
Brewster is accident-prone, and he's pretty bad-mannered even by ex-mag standards, but he wouldn't betray us.
No, ma'am. I guess he wouldn't.
We'll only go a little way, just to get the lay of the land. Worst-case scenario is that we run into trouble and fire off a couple of shots to let you know.
Yes, sir.
Kane, Grant, and Bridget moved away from the perimeter of the settlement and followed a scattering of footprints up along the face of a dune.
I don't know if firing off some signal shots is a good idea. Remember what Gray said about noise attracting ghosts.
The sand bogged around their ankles as they climbed. When they reached the crest of the dune, Kane studied the massive thrust of dark rock Gray called Phantom Mesa. It stood like a giant sentinel of the desert. Bridget tested her contact and grimaced in frustration.
Static. We're still under the jamming umbrella. Kane, you never should have let Brewster go out alone.
I didn't let him, and you know it. He waited until my back was turned and took off with a power analyzer. He thought he could trace down the origin of the jamming.
Bridget nodded, her emerald eyes clouded by worry.
Brewster is far too headstrong for a scientist.
I don't know about that, but he's sure as hell clumsy.
Grant suddenly halted, indicating with a hand wave for his partners to do the same. He leaned forward, head cocked to the right, his expression intent.
I hear something.
Kane strained his hearing. Through narrowed eyes, he scanned the ridge of the dune 30 feet ahead, but saw nothing. Then a figure suddenly lurched over the top of the dune and fell awkwardly, his body plowing a trench through the sand. Long legs thrashed. The shape rolled to the bottom and lay there, struggling feebly. The Cerberus warrior scrambled down the dune and surrounded the figure, whose wrists were bound behind his back. Terrified and pain-filled snarls twisted split and bloody lips. Kane clutched the man by the shoulders.
Take it easy. You're safe now.
Kneeling, Kane carefully eased the limp body over. He saw the man's face in the fading light and winced. It was Brewster Filboid. Filboid's face was contorted with feral terror, but when he recognized Kane, Bridget Baptiste, and Grant, his tense muscles relaxed in relief.
About time.
In his mid-40s, Brewster Filboid was a little over 6 feet tall, long-limbed and lanky. Blonde white hair was swept back from a receding hairline. Normally, he wore black-rimmed eyeglasses. Like Cat Alpha, he wore desert camouflage BDUs. Bridget pulled him up and held him in a sitting position while Grant cut through the ropes binding his wrists. Philboyd's face was bruised, his left eye all but swollen shut. Dry blood caked the area around his nose and mouth.
Are you all right?
They just slapped me around some.
Kane opened up his canteen and helped Philboy drink.
Who are they?
Four men jumped me about 3/4 of a mile from here. They tied me up. They asked me some questions, and all I told them was my name. I thought I heard a woman's voice, but I couldn't be sure. After that, they started asking me about Cerberus, how many of us were out here, and if you three specifically were in the vicinity.
How'd they know about us?
Beats the hell out of me.
Glancing at Grant, both Kane and Bridget could guess his thoughts. Brewster Philboyd was one of many expatriates from the Manetius moon base who had chosen to forge new lives for themselves with the Cerberus warriors. Although the majority of the former lunar colonists were academics, they had proved their inherent courage and resourcefulness and wanted to get out into the world and make a difference in the struggle to reclaim the planet of their birth. For 3 years, Kane, Bridget, and Grant had struggled to dismantle the machine of baronial tyranny in America. Victory over the Nine Barons, if not precisely within their grasp, did not seem a completely unreachable goal. But then, unexpectedly, nearly 2 years before, the entire dynamic of the struggle against the Nine Barons changed. The Cerberus warriors learned that the fragile hybrid barons, despite being close to a century old, were only in a larval stage of their development. Overnight, the barons changed. When that happened, the war against the baronies themselves ended, but a new one, far greater in scope, began. The barons had simply walked away from their vills, their territories, and their subjects. When they reached the final stage in their development, they saw no need for the trappings of semi-divinity, nor were they content to rule such minor kingdoms. When they evolved into their true forms, incarnations of the ancient Anunnaki overlords, their avaricious scope expanded to encompass the entire world and every thinking creature on it. Even 2+ years after the disappearance of the barons, the Vils were still in states of anarchy, with various factions warring for control on a daily basis. A number of former magistrates, weary of fighting for one transitory ruling faction or another that tried to fill the power vacuum in the Vils, responded to the outreach efforts of Cerberus. Once the magistrates joined Cerberus, Kane and Grant had seen to the formation of Cerberus away teams Alpha, Beta, and Delta.
Do you have any idea of what the Millennial Consortium is looking for out here?
Brewster Philboyd waved to the desert at large.
I think we'll have to find our own answers.
Nothing new about that. How did you escape?
To be honest, I don't really know. About half an hour ago, I realized I was alone. Everybody had just left me. I sort of got the impression that the consortium had a bigger problem to deal with than just me.
Something to do with ghosts?
Philboyd swung his head toward her.
You know, I thought I heard one of the millennialists say something about ghosts, but I thought I misheard him. Figured he was talking about something else.
Do you at least know if the consortium has found a base out here?
Logically, I'd have to say yes, but I haven't seen it. But the energy emissions were strongest in the direction of that big mesa over there.
How are they getting to and from the place?
Philboyd opened his mouth to answer, then his shoulders stiffened. Grant looked at him quizzically, then tilted his head back to scan the darkening sky.
Everybody down!
They huddled into the shadow cast by the dune. Craning his neck, Kane glimpsed a big transport chopper angling in from the south. Red and yellow navigation lights glowed along its undercarriage.
An MH-6 transport. Not a common piece of ordnance nowadays.
The machine did not fly over them, but instead inscribed a half-circle around Phantom Mesa and sank from view. The sound of its vanes faded away. Kane straightened up, brushing sand from his clothes.
Brewster, do you think you can make it back to the settlement on your own?
Philboyd frowned and slowly climbed to his feet, massaging his wrists.
I think so.
Good. Tell Edwards to bring the team and follow our tracks. We'll head out toward the mesa.
What about me?
You'll stay behind and guard our prisoner.
Prisoner?
Yeah. A guy named Gray. He's hurt pretty badly, so we won't give you any trouble.
Wincing, Philboyd touched his bruised face.
Yeah, if it's all the same to you, I'd prefer to go with you.
It's not the same to me. You took off against my express orders to stay put. You got jumped and beat to hell, and now you're no good to us.
Yeah, but the energy readings I picked up are localized in the area of that mesa. That's where the jamming umbrella is transmitting the white noise.
We figured that out without being captured and having the crap kicked out of us.
Kane pointed in the direction of the village.
Do as I say for once. Go back and stay put.
Philboyd looked to be on the verge of arguing, but then his shoulders slumped in resignation. Without another word or a backward glance, he began trudging up the face of the sand dune. After he topped the rise, Bridget turned to Kane, her eyes glittering with anger.
There was no need to be so hard on him. He only wanted to pull his own weight.
Brewster is an academic. Every time he goes out into the field, something like this happens to him. If we weren't around to pull his ass out of the various fires he falls into, he would have been dead long ago.
And this time he gave us away to the Millennialists.
Not intentionally. Somebody recognized him. Whoever it was would have recognized us too. It was just Brewster's bad luck to be spotted first.
Yeah, and either they didn't think Brewster was worth wasting a bullet on, or they wanted to save all they had to settle a larger problem.
Like what?
Let's go see, why don't we?
The three people marched swiftly toward the immense pinnacle of rock, noting the rubble piled high around its base, nearly 300 feet in height. As sunset progressed, the deep fissures scoring the surface of the gigantic monolith became fathomless black shadows. Alert for sentries or motion detectors, the Cerberus warriors didn't speak. Bridget Baptiste suddenly trotted ahead. An unusual shape humped up from the ground. A small wave of sand had all but buried it, but in the dim light, metal glinted. She picked up the rectangular power analyzer, a device designed to measure, record, and analyze energy emissions, quality, and harmonics.
At least we don't have to charge this back to Brewster.
She swept the extended sensor stem back and forth in short left-to-right arcs, then pointed it toward the mesa. The device's LCD glowed steadily, and the readout indicated the energy signature was very strong.
Whatever it is, we're almost on top of it.
The Cerberus warriors started walking again, scaling a shale-littered slope that led to a flat summit. They dropped to their hands and knees, then belly-crawled to the top. They stared for a long time in the fading light. They saw a cup-like crater nestled at the base of Phantom Mesa, bracketed by broken edges of butte rock on the far side. The depression covered several acres and was surrounded by the remains of a chain-link fence. The floor of the crater was bored flat. A road led toward a dark defile at the foot of the mesa. It was blocked by a metal gate. Part of the open field was sheltered by a roof-like overhang of rock, jutting out from the side of the mesa. Metal gleamed under the roof, and a half-dome of translucent plexiglass reflected the dimming sunlight. The transport helicopter was parked near it, the rotors spinning. Kane focused his attention on a large steel plate at the bottom of the shallow crater. Several people, clad in dun-colored coveralls, stood around it as if they were waiting for something to happen. On the far side of the crater, men bustled about with a military precision. Suddenly, Bridget Baptiste put her mouth close to Kane's ear.
I hear something.
Kane turned his head slightly as a tall shadow stretched up from the lip of rock. He carried a sleek, black Coleco M750 subgun, outfitted with a long noise suppressor. Kane remained flat on the ledge of rock as the man in the dun-colored coverall reached the summit. The man juggled the Coleco as he wiped his nose on the sleeve of his garment. Kane rose silently and slammed his sin-eater-weighted forearm against the back of the man's head. The man staggered, half-turning, to topple off the rim. Kane caught him by one arm and yanked him forward. The Coleco clattered on the rock, and Bridget snatched it up. The man fell heavily on his face, only a few inches away from Grant. The Cerberus warriors waited quietly for a handful of seconds, watching and listening for a general alarm to be raised. The helicopter rose, the rotor blades whipping eddies of dust all over the crater. Swiveling, the aircraft's nose pointed eastward, banked to port, then arrowed away.
I wonder who or what is aboard the chopper. They seem to be in a hurry.
Moving swiftly, Bridget removed a set of nylon cuffs from a pants pocket and slipped them over the unconscious man's hands, snugging his wrists tightly together. Grant fashioned a serviceable gag from a bandana and knotted the ends at the back of the man's neck. Kane gazed down at the activity in the depression, noting the swarthy complexions among the people standing around the gleaming metal plate.
It looks like they've got the locals busy.
Grant rose to a knee, his eyes narrowed.
Busy doing what?
I get the feeling they're packing up and moving out.
Should we stroll down and ask what they're up to, or wait for the rest of the team? I'd like to avoid a firefight, if at all possible.
Yeah, so would I.
Grant looked up at the sky.
No wonder our satellites couldn't locate this place. Shielded by the rock this way, we could fly over it a couple of hundred feet and never know the place was here.
Down!
Kane threw himself down, flat to the lip of the rock. Just as what was left of the sun's glow vanished below the horizon, the crater was splashed by a multicolored shimmer. Down below, the laborers pulled aside the metal plate in the ground and then ran toward the gate at the base of the mesa. From a round aperture in the crater floor, a slender metal column rose straight up, pointing like a steel finger toward the sky.
What the hell?
The top of the metal finger sprouted gleaming armatures, webworks of steel mesh unfolding and stretching outward. They formed shallow, disc-shaped dishes. The column continued to rise until it towered 50 feet above the crater floor. Kane lifted his head, seeing activity by the gate at the base of the looming mesa. Movement shifted at the corner of his eye, and he saw a man wearing the standard dun-drab coverall climb up to the ledge. A calico was slung over his left shoulder, and he stared downward at the crater. As soon as Kane saw him, the millennialist turned his head and spotted Kane. Their eyes locked for what seemed like a long time. The sentry's mouth worked as he yelled something, but his voice was completely smothered by the electronic whine from below. He struggled to bring his calico to bear, but the long sound suppressor made swift movement impossible. Kane launched himself from the ground as the guard unslung his weapon. He slashed the noise suppressor at Kane's head, missed, and hit his right shoulder. A fireball of pain exploded in Kane's shoulder socket, and then he knocked the man down. They rolled and bumped down the slope, hitting big rocks with bone-jarring impacts. They thrashed together down to the base of the slope. Kane tried to hit him, but his right arm was numb, barely responsive. He grabbed the silencer of the calico with his left hand, and the sentry twisted over with a convulsion of his body. He threw his weight against the subgun, pressing the barrel across Kane's neck, pinning him against the ground. Kane tried to break free by arching his back and bucking upward, but the sentry was heavy and surprisingly powerful. His teeth bared in a grin of triumph as he put more pressure on the metal across Kane's throat. Kane glimpsed a shifting movement. The millennialist went limp and fell half on top of him. Brigid stood over the man, feet spread, her appropriated subgun reversed in her hands. She had used the blunt stock to club the man into unconsciousness. Breathing hard, Kane elbowed aside the unconscious man. He staggered to his feet, rubbing his throat.
Thanks, Baptiste.
From a pocket, he produced his own set of nylon cuffs and bound the man's wrists.
Why didn't you just shoot him?
Because you said you didn't want to start a firefight.
Kane picked up the millennialist's calico.
Now we have a matched set.
They began climbing up the crater wall again. When they reached the top of the slope and rejoined Grant, they saw that the slender metal tower was slowly rotating, the discs made of mesh angling downward. Grant glanced over his shoulder at them.
You okay?
Fine. Thanks for all your assistance.
Well, I knew you could take them, with Bridget's help.
They eyed the metal tower. Although the electronic whine had faded, miniature skeins of lightning played along the rims of the dishes.
What the hell is that supposed to be?
I have no idea. My market for speculation is open.
I'd sell it if I had it. At first glance, I'd say it looks like a microwave pulse transmitter. But my gut tells me it's something else entirely.
Let's go take a closer look, since nobody's around.
There could be a good reason nobody's around.
Brigid pressed the contact behind her ear again, but shook her head.
Still blocked. There's no calling for help if we get ourselves trapped.
Since when do we call for help?
Kane chose to ignore that. He rose and walked along the ridge until he found the path that the sentries had climbed. The Cerberus warriors descended into the crater, alert for other guards, but they saw no one. They strode across the crater, giving the steel column a wide berth. The Cerberus warriors walked toward the metal gate and saw it hanging ajar, dim light spilling out from between the flat slats. The square-cut passageway beyond the door stretched away into gloom. Keeping close to the right-hand wall, they followed the curve of the tunnel until it ended at a circular well pit with metal steps spiraling down.
Why does it always have to be underground?
Kane crooked a half-smile at her and took the first step, careful that the risers did not creak or squeak beneath his weight. The staircase corkscrewed down only a couple of yards before ending at a low-ceilinged foyer. Stenciled on the wall in red were the letters, Property of DARPA, IEEE approved. Must have A-10 clearance ID to proceed. Brigid's eyes darted back and forth as she read the words.
Definitely a pre-dark scientific testing facility.
More fucking acronyms. They couldn't ever spell anything out? What kind of installation is it?
Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency and the Institute of Electrical and Electronics Engineers gave this place its seal of approval, if that means anything.
Not anymore, it doesn't. Let's see what we've got here.
What do you expect to find?
How do I know? That's why I suggested we explore.
Just about every time we explore one of these places, we end up having to run out of it as fast as we can.
The team moved forward cautiously. At a cross corridor, they passed a small cafeteria-type dining room, equipped with two upright refrigerators and a large coffee maker. But no one was seated at the long tables. On the opposite side of the passageway lay an office suite, furnished with a dozen desks, computer stations, and file cabinets.
Where is everybody? We saw them come in here, and the place can only be so big.
Maybe there's a back way out.
The corridor turned to the left like an L. They passed a sign on the wall at the angle that read, Los Alamos Shuttle. An arrow pointed ahead in the direction they walked. Kane glanced around uneasily.
Maybe that's the back door they took.
Could be, but why?
The hallway terminated in a door emblazoned with the warning, No unauthorized admittance.
That means us. Wait.
Grant tried the knob, and to his surprise, it turned easily. Carefully, he pushed the door open and entered a narrow passage illuminated by naked light bulbs in ceiling fixtures. The three people navigated through a labyrinth of pipes, fuse boxes, and cooling systems, all the machinery that kept the installation alive and self-sufficient. Grant, Kane, and Bridget, hearing the hum in the distance, glanced at each other.
You feel that?
Yeah. Makes the back of my neck tight.
This is starting to give me a headache.
Me too. Something about the harmonics being produced, I think.
Keep moving. The sooner we get some decent intel, the sooner we can get out of here.
The passageway opened directly into a large circular room, the curving walls lined by consoles. The control surfaces flashed and glowed with various icons and indicator lights. A stainless steel shaft mounted in a drum-shaped socket rose from the floor and continued through the domed roof.
Here's where the tower is raised. Whatever the hell it really is.
Three crystalline hoops surrounded the drum socket at the base of the shaft. The hoops turned slowly. The throbbing harmonics felt like steel bands around their craniums, squeezing and compressing as if their heads were trapped in tightening vices.
Let's get out of here. My head is really hurting.
Yeah, like my skull is pinching my brain or something.
Just a second. Look here at the control boards. See the similarity of symbols and letters glowing on these monitor screens? The circle and ovoid combination representing the Greek letter theta is repeated over and over. And this.
Bridget stared at the center screen showing a column of numbers, the digits clocking backward. Suddenly, realization washed over her like a flood of icy water. She whirled toward her friends.
We've got to get out of here right now.
She moved swiftly toward the door. Grant and Kane fell into step behind her.
What's the problem, Baptiste?
I think what we've got here is a theta pinch transmitter.
A what?
It's a form of experimental fusion physics. By magnetically compressing electrically conducting filaments, it creates an electromagnetic field that implodes rather than expands. They occur naturally in electrical discharges such as lightning bolts.
What the hell is something like that for?
Research into supergravity theory, from what I recall. I think it's set on a countdown to some sort of energy discharge. I'll explain when we're out of here.
I'm looking forward to it.
They quickly retraced their steps, climbing back up the spiral staircase. As they ran toward the gate, relief washed through Kane when he saw it still hung open. A towering figure suddenly appeared on the other side of the gate.
Damn it!
He snapped up the Coleco, finger curling around the trigger. Kane reflected grimly that they had been lucky so far, but now, typically, their luck had run out. Edwards frantically hurled his body to one side.
It's me!
Shit, Edwards. I nearly killed you.
Kane, Bridget, and Grant ran over to where the rest of Cat Alpha stood in the crater, gazing at the spark-shedding and crackling metal transmission tower.
What's going on here? Where the hell is everybody?
How'd you get here?
We followed your tracks.
You didn't find a couple of consortium guys tied up?
No, sir. Were we supposed to?
Bridget eyed the dishes on either side of the metal tower apprehensively, noting the greenish aura shimmering around them.
I think we've been had. Let's double time it out of here.
We're gonna leave this place unsecured?
Edwards gestured with his rifle barrel to the tunnel entrance. Bridget's lips compressed.
I don't think we have much choice. I think the consortium abandoned this place for a reason.
Like what? Besides headaches?
Edwards eyed Kane in surprise.
All of us have headaches, and I'm starting to feel sick to my stomach.
What's causing this? Radiation?
Glancing up at the indigo sky and the first emerging stars of the evening, Bridget frowned.
I have no idea, but if they don't want the place, we probably wouldn't either.
Move!
The ground trembled under their feet. Several sharp daggers of light burst from the discs mounted atop the metal tower. From the mouth of the passageway gushed a billow of flame and smoke. A tremendous explosion cannonaded up from the throat of the tunnel, and a brutal column of concussive force slammed into them like an invisible tsunami, buffeting them backward. Acrid black fumes grabbed everyone by the throat. The entire crater floor shook and trembled. Rifts split the ground. Rocks and dirt shaken loose from the mesa tumbled down. A fissure opened up around the mouth of the tunnel, rending rock and rupturing metal. Boulders toppled down from above, blocking the entrance to the tunnel. The people moved away, staggering on the convulsing earth. They ran out in the center of the crater to avoid being crushed by rocks falling from the mesa.
What the fuck is going on?
Bridget shook her head, fanning the dust-laced air away from her face.
The station was set to self-destruct. God knows why.
We can tell you. Don't move. It's very important that you stay as motionless as possible.
The metal tower bent, sagging downward at a 45-degree angle. The crackling, popping pyrotechnic display around the metal mesh discs didn't ebb. Slowly, the ground tremors eased. The crater floor lit up with blinding rods of brightness. The searchlight beams stabbed through the night and intersected with the bodies of Cerberus Away Team Alpha, pinned like butterflies to a board. Squinting, Kane shielded his eyes, bringing up his Kaliko.
Fuck them.
Edwards' finger crooked around the trigger of his rifle.
If they meant to kill us, they'd have done it already instead of just threatening us.
I think we're being warned, not threatened. They didn't tell us to drop our weapons.
Trapped in the dazzling exposure of the light, Kane figured the Millennial Consortium really didn't care one way or the other if they were disarmed. They had other matters occupying them. Beyond the blinding circle of the handheld spotlight, he could barely make out man-shaped shadows arrayed on the ridgeline.
Who are we talking to?
Shh. Call me Mr. Blue. It doesn't matter. What does matter is that you don't move until we tell you to.
Why?
Shh.
Don't shush me. Are you responsible for blowing up the installation?
Shh. Don't make any noise. Be as quiet as you can and don't move. Stay in the light if you value your lives.
Mystified, but feeling sweat form on his hairline, Kane cut his gaze over to Bridget.
Is he crazy or what?
Your guess is as good as mine. For the time being, we probably should do as he says, until we can get a better idea of what's going on here.
Higson, one of the CAT team members, sneered, his lip curling, showing his teeth.
Nothing is going on around here, except we're being set up to be slaughtered.
Kane considered Higson's words for a thoughtful second, then the sparks dancing along the rims of the discs suddenly faded away. He found the phenomenon worrisome, not comforting. At the same time, the glare of the spotlight dimmed. He sensed it hadn't been done to spare their vision.
Shut up and be quiet!
Kane blinked, trying to clear his vision of the amoeba-shaped floaters swimming over his eyes. His flesh suddenly prickled with a pins and needles sensation, almost as if a multitude of ants crawled over his skin. He felt rather than heard a feathery fluttering against his eardrums. His stomach surged with nausea. Edward shuddered and wiped his face with one hand.
Something is going on here.
The spotlight dimmed even more, becoming little more than a faint yellow halo.
It's like the power is being drained. Localized ionization of the atmosphere, too.
Higson shifted his feet nervously, clutching his gun.
What the fuck is that?
Kane followed the man's gaze toward the smoke-occluded opening in the base of the mesa. Movement shifted within the roiling vapors, and a green-hued light flickered in the haze. A faint, cold breeze touched his face, ruffling his hair. The green light whirled, bathing the entire crater in an emerald glow. Then, slowly, the light contorted into the outline of a human figure. Kane gazed, transfixed, his mind a whirl of bewilderment. He felt his throat constrict, and his heart began pounding in a sudden terror. The green figure twisted, stretching outward, growing broader. It split into another shape of identical size and dimension.
Too late! Run!
Cerberus Away Team Alpha retreated from the ghostly, nebulous bodies, backing away toward the crater wall. The figures resembled cadavers, glistening with a coating of green phosphorus. Their facial features were always in flux, sliding and reforming like smoke. Two more appeared, gliding over the ground toward them. Fingers like wisps of emerald smoke reached out at the end of skeletal arms, convulsing with grasping and clutching movements. The wraiths spread out in a horseshoe formation, clouds of fluorescent particles swarming around them. Kane raised the appropriated Kaliko to his shoulder, sighted down its length.
Fire!
He squeezed off a long, rattling burst. Grant, Bridget, and the other members of CAT Alpha triggered simultaneous full-auto fusillades. The barrage ripped through the wraiths, punching holes, ripping them to shreds. The figures instantly reformed, resolving into a dozen wavering green ghostly shapes. Tiny pieces of green light floated over their heads like a swarm of radioactive fireflies.
Cease fire! Fall back!
CAT Alpha sprinted up the slope to the ridge surrounding the crater, causing miniature avalanches under their feet. Kane, Higson, and Grant remained at the base of the crater wall, eyes and gun barrels fixed on the cluster of green ghosts less than 10 yards away. Higson snatched a round V-60 mini-grenade from his combat webbing and ran at an oblique angle away from the rest of the team.
Keep going!
Get your ass back here!
Higson paid no attention to the command. Swiftly, he unpinned the grenade and hurled it overhead into the center of the glowing green wraiths. Then he flung himself flat, covering up, face buried in the cradle of his arms. The V-60 exploded in a ballooning ball of flame. The concussion slapped Kane and Grant backward a few paces. Dust sifted down, and they impatiently waved it away. Although they didn't see the ghostly figures, they saw the little swarm of orbs surrounding Higson. He leaped to his feet and flailed at them with the frame of his rifle, without making solid impact. The cloud settled over the man's head and shoulders, spreading over his face. When he opened his mouth to scream again, two of the orbs darted past his lips. Dropping his rifle, he ran in a blind panic across the crater, hands clapped over his eyes.
Baptiste, get everybody back to the parallax point.
Kane didn't wait to find out if she obeyed his order or had even heard it. He and Grant sprinted after the frantically fleeing Higson. The man stumbled over an irregularity on the ground and fell heavily. He writhed, limbs thrashing in wild spasms. By the time Grant and Kane reached him, the swarm of green orbs had lifted from the man's body and circled high overhead. Higson lay sprawled on his back, saliva bubbling over swollen lips, his respiration shallow. Kane recoiled at the sight of his face. The blotched flesh leaked and suppurated as if suddenly exposed to a horrific blast of heat. Tiny blisters formed on his cheeks and burst with pops. The whites of his eyes showed only bloodshot streaks.
He's still alive.
Stooping over the body, Kane pressed two fingers against the base of Higson's neck, timing the pulse. It beat fast and erratic.
Not for long.
When Kane removed his fingers, a layer of Higson's flesh peeled off.
It's like he's rotting from the inside out.
Not so much rotting as disintegrating.
Even as he spoke, the left side of Higson's face went slack, sagging from the bone. Like a wet rag, the flesh completely fell away, revealing red-filmed cheekbone. The man shuddered violently for a moment, then died. A puff of gray-green vapor rose from his mouth. As Grant and Kane watched in stunned, shocked silence, Higson's body, beneath his clothes, collapsed in on itself, the flesh and bones dissolving into a foul-smelling green smoke. The cloud was shot through with tiny crackling flashes like miniature versions of the pyrotechnics they had seen dancing on the tower's discs. Kane backed away, feeling bile rise up his throat.
Let's get out of here.
And leave Higson?
There's not much to take with us.
He eyed the witchfire glow of the green orbs still hovering overhead.
We need to go before we end up like he did.
We don't know what was going on here.
Kane nodded and backed away, keeping his gaze on the ghostly swarm.
Exactly. That's why we need to get the hell out of here as fast as we can.
Time to reload. Outlanders is continued on the next CD.